Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Sandra Goldberg Lecture on a beautiful summer day. My name is Richard Kruse. With Kathy Flanders, I'm co-chair of the Council on Palliative Care, and I would very much like to welcome you to the 16th Sandra Goldberg Lecture. Just a word on the Council on Palliative Care. The Council was formed in 1994 in order to serve as an advocacy group for palliative care in our community and beyond. It's made up of community representatives, volunteers, and professionals, all interested in end-of-life care and specifically palliative care. In the many years that we've been functioning, we have provided the community with a regular series of workshops that have been well attended. We try and do at least two a year. We sponsor activities at the International Palliative Care Congress. We give an annual David Burke Lecture. David was a very wonderful early member of the council and co-chair. And, of course, we sponsor the Sandra Goldberg Lecture. Sandra Goldberg was a wonderful lady who was treated by one of our palliative care physicians. And in order to keep her memory alive, the family has sponsored this lecture, and we are very grateful to them and to the other sponsors listed, or that were listed on the screen. It's been a regular event and sort of a centerpiece of palliative care activities that we have within our local community. The council takes its advocacy role seriously. We're delighted that there was an announcement today that further resources will go to palliative care, and we trust that they will be wisely used. They certainly are needed. We've done a variety of things with this lecture, and as Monty Python would say, now for something a little different. We're absolutely delighted to have with us, and I apologize for having to read, but Will Schaub is somebody who we think can contribute a lot to our conversations. He's the author of the End of Your Life Book Club, which is an account of conversations that he had with his mother when she returned from Afghanistan with a terminal illness. It's won many awards, was a New York Times bestseller for quite a while. He's obviously done many things. It's kind of hard to categorize them all. He's the founder and CEO of CookStir.com, which is a recipe site featuring great recipes from many of the world's best chefs and cookbook authors, and we certainly hope that he's interested in nutrition at end of life, too, because he can contribute to that. Prior to that, he was Senior Vice President and Editor-in-Chief of Hyperion Books. He's worked as a journalist, writing articles and reviews for the New York Times, South China Morning Post, Insight for Asian Investors, MS Magazine, and Business Travel Asia. He's the author with David Shipley of SEND, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better, and I'm certainly going to get that because I can use it. And he serves on the Board of Governors, the Asian American Writers Workshop, Yale University Press, and the Kingsborough Community College Foundation. He's from New York, and we're absolutely delighted he's with us. Now, Louise Penny is, in fact, one of us, so it's wonderful to have her back. She also is a New York Times bestseller. She worked as a CBC journalist before she turned to writing fiction, and she's probably forgot. But if I remember correctly, she was interested in 15th century religious persecution when she started off. But she didn't last long in that role. Am I wrong?
That's true. In
205, her first novel, Still Life, was published. Went on to be translated in 25 languages. And she's had a bundle of awards since then. She's one of the most decorated crime fiction writers in the world. She created Inspector Gamache, who is a Quebec policeman. And these are featured in countless editors' picks and best crime novels and so forth. Her eighth book, Beautiful Mystery, was published earlier this year and got great reviews and is at number two on the New York Times bestseller list. So this is quite a famous lady we've got. However, many of us know that the actual high point of her career was when she served on the first iteration of the Council on Palliative Care, which was quite wonderful. She had been a palliative care volunteer at the Royal Victoria Hospital and has had a long-standing interest in this subject. So now I'm going to sit down and we are going to listen to a discourse.
Thank you. Thank you, Dean Cruz.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's actually an interesting gathering, isn't it, that that I kill them and...
Yes.
And you write about them.
And I write about them.
I wasn't going to say much about Will. I was going to just let him read to introduce himself, which I will do in a moment. So I want to mention, too, that Will and I are going to chat for about 30, 35, maybe 40 minutes or so. But really what we'd love to do is open up for questions from the audience, which I think we're going to be doing as written questions. That's right. So if you could write, if you have questions, if you could write them down, that would help us a great deal. Will Schwalbe's book, The End of Your Life Book Club, as Dean Cruz said, has won international praise and recognition. It's a bestseller, has been chosen for awards and distinctions, but far more important than that, it has struck not a nerve, but a comforting chord with readers all over the world for its humor and humanity in talking about the end of our lives and how we face the loss of someone we love, in his case, his mother, Mary Ann Schwalbe. I suspect since you are here, you probably have faced the death of someone close to you or walking that road right now. The End of Your Life Book Club isn't primarily a book about dying, but about living, about the choices we make, about a passion for storytelling and that territory, where that can take us into that territory where we would never normally have the courage to visit. Ladies and gentlemen, Will Schwalbe. I wonder, Will, if you could maybe introduce yourself by reading a short selection from your book.
I would love to do that. Thank you. And I just want to say first how moved I am to be here amongst all of you in this gorgeous city, sitting across from an author I admire so very much, and talking about palliative care at the invitation of the Council on Palliative Care. It's something I've come to care about so very much, and it's also introduced me to so many extraordinary people who care and want to engage about these issues. So thank you so much. And thank you for the nice introduction, too. So I'll start to read a passage.
That would be lovely.
This is from a chapter called People of the Book. Every chapter is named after one of the books that my mother and I read. It had been just over 2 months since Mom's diagnosis, and we were sitting, waiting for the result of the first scan she'd had after starting chemo. And I couldn't, for the life of me, figure out how to live her dying. We didn't know if she would have 3 months, or six, or a year, or if we were amazingly lucky, two, or if we were miraculously lucky, five. Imagine that you had a book set aside for a long plane trip, but you didn't know how long the book was. It might be as short as Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, or it might be as long as his The Magic Mountain. And you wouldn't know until you came to the end. If it was Death in Venice, you might find that you'd race through it and now had nothing to read for the rest of the flight. But if it was The Magic Mountain, and you'd read sparingly so that the book would last the whole trip, you might discover you'd barely made a dent, and who knows when you'd have time to scale it again. We were going to have to learn how to pace ourselves, which routines we could keep and which we had to jettison, what we could try to cram in and what we had to give up, which occasions we would be sure to celebrate no matter what and which we would ignore, which books we were still going to read and which we would abandon, and even when we would focus on her dying and when we would talk about anything but.
That's beautiful. And I love this book, and that is one example of why. How do you feel reading that? Do you go back to that time as you read that section? Do you allow yourself to feel things?
I do. I mean, I love engaging with the book, and I like talking about my mother. And one of the interesting things that happened when I told friends I was writing this book is friends had a very similar reaction. A lot of people said to me, "So great you're doing it because it will give you closure." And I wound up saying to them, I appreciate that sentiment, but I don't want closure. What I really want to do is continue our conversations. And so when I wrote the book, and when I read from the book, and when I meet people and talk about the book, I feel that's what I'm doing, is I'm continuing the conversations.
Tell us about your mother.
So my mother was from the first generation of women who worked both by choice and necessity. And as far as I can remember, she worked. When I was growing up, we grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and my mother was first in the admissions office at Radcliffe and then became director of admissions at Harvard Radcliffe. And she was the first woman president of the Harvard Faculty Club, and she was a tenured administrator. And actually, in her childhood, she'd wanted to be an actress, and she'd worked for a wonderful producer, Irene Selznick. And so she came out of the theater, and it's a kind of funny story because the way she found herself into admissions is, since she'd been in the theater, she knew how to cast plays. So she cast the freshman class at Harvard Radcliffe.
She did. We need a tall, thin man.
We need a tall, so put together a great group. So I always grew up but I cringe when I call a working mother because my mother hated the phrase working mother. She always said, no one ever talks about working fathers. I'm a mother and I work.
Were you close to your mother growing up?
Very, very close to her. She was busy and worked, and I think I grew up in an age of benign neglect. So it was very common. When they said get lost, they kind of meant it.
You have a hilarious story in here about one of your toys.
Yes.
And this is something that when your mother was diagnosed and you were, this is part of the book club, and it allowed you to talk about this. Tell us about that, unless you're going to need therapy after.
No, I'm delighted. I actually thought this was a funny story.
Because I think there might be some psychiatrist.
Oh, yes, is any, raise your hand. I thought this was a very funny story when I told it in the book, but it slightly horrified some people. But for the record, I still think it's a funny story.
I thought it was funny.
Good, thank you.
I write murder mysteries.
Yeah. So maybe not the most reliable. So I was one of those little kids who was just obsessed with stuffed animals, and I had a whole collection of them, and it was very, in a sort of mildly OCD way, very important to me that I give equal attention to each one, and it was very elaborate. And I was going on a trip to visit some relative or something, and I was well under 10, I don't know how old I was, and I took some little stuffed animals with me, but my favorite really was this enormous stuffed turtle, creatively nicknamed Turtle. And when I came back, Turtle was gone. And I had said to my mother, "Where's Turtle?" To which my mother blurted out, "He died." Now, I think even at that age, I kind of knew that stuffed animals don't die. And so what it turned out later is someone had come on a, this is very typical of my mother, who, if you read the book, you will get to know in this way, someone had come by on a drive to have toys and clothing for kids in a local orphanage, and my mother, without thinking, said, "Sure, take Turtle." But she didn't want to fess up to me, so she told me Turtle had died. And as we were sitting in chemo as part of the conversations of this this book, I relayed that story and reminded my mother of it. And she fessed up that the turtle had gone to an orphanage. And then she asked me, "Are you still mad at me?" And I had to say, in a moment of complete honesty, a little.
What role did books play in her life?
Books for my mother were how you knew what you needed to do. Books were life's operating manual. And I should add, sort of completing my mother's bio, my family moved back to New York, and my mother became continued as an educator, and was a college counselor, and then head of a girls' high school. And then when she was in her 50s, thanks to a mysterious postcard from a nun, she discovered the cause of refugees. And she said to my father, I love you, I'll be back, and moved in her mid-50s to a refugee camp on the Thai-Lao border. My sister just graduated from college. My sister went with her. And when they came back, my mother gave notice at her job and became founding director of something called the Women's Commission for Women and Children Refugees, which was the only organization at the time devoted to the cause of women and children refugees. So that conveys the bio. Back to your question, Mom felt very keenly that if you read a book and you were moved by it, you had a responsibility to do something about it. That if you read The Kite Runner, a book we loved, or A Thousand Splendid Suns, you couldn't close the book and say, well, that was very moving, I cried. You had to say, what am I going to do about Afghanistan? Is there anything I can do? Is there a letter I can write? Is there a check I can send? Is there an Afghan refugee in my community who I can invite to Thanksgiving? But you had to do something. And all her life, books told her what she needed to do, and she expected them to do the same for us.
Tell us about her diagnosis.
So as part of my mother's refugee activities, she went 10 times to Pakistan and Afghanistan, a country she absolutely loved. And when...
I can just interrupt, too. By now, of course, she's into her 70s.
Into her 70s,
so, right.
Yeah. And still going. She had a very... my mother was a very devout Christian. I am very not. and she did have an opinion that she thought when you got to be a certain age, you should volunteer for the most dangerous missions. Because she felt she'd had a wonderful, full life and children and grandchildren, and she hated the idea of sending young people into the field, into dangerous places. She thought people like her should go, and she loved it. But she came back from this, I think her 10th trip to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and she was just feeling rotten. She really, really didn't feel well. And at first they thought it was hepatitis of some kind, and they realized it wasn't A, it wasn't B, it wasn't C, it wasn't D, it wasn't E. I didn't even know there was a hepatitis E, but apparently there's a hepatitis E. And she got, usually she came back from trips, and she had something wrong with her. But the something usually went away. And this just got worse and worse. And then my sister finally pushed for ever more tests, ever more doctors. And in October 2007, she was diagnosed with stage 4B pancreatic cancer, which means it had spread to other organs. So when I read that passage about... We didn't know if we'd have 6 months or a year or two or if we're miraculously five. That's because so many people of stage 4 pancreatic cancer die within 3 to 6 months.
There was a stage in the book, too, where you described she had to go in, obviously, for blood tests and the chemo. And at one stage, a young, I think, researcher was interviewing her. And I don't know if she used the term, I've forgotten now the term terminal, and your mother turned to you afterward and said, that's the first time I heard that it was terminal. I mean, she must have known, but to have heard the word. Was it the word terminal?
It was the stage 4.
Oh, it was the stage 4. She hadn't heard it staged.
She hadn't heard staged.
Right.
She heard that she had cancer, that it had spread, that it was not curable, that it was treatable. She knew it was pancreatic cancer. We'd all looked on the internet and seen one sort of horrifying thing after another. Mm-hmm. But she hadn't heard it staged. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
I was very moved by that line about you didn't know how to live for dying. How did you figure it out?
There were a couple of very important ways we figured it out. One is we were very lucky to have the service of some extraordinary people in palliative care. Mm-hmm. And one in particular named Nessa Coyle, who is a very well-known and wonderful person in this field. And I write in the book how my first reaction was, well, gee, athletes have coaches and executives have coaches, and I guess she's kind of a death coach. But then I came to realize very quickly that she was a life coach. And she gave wonderful, wonderful advice. And she told my mother things like, make plans, and then cancel them. She told my mother and all of us, if you want to sit at home and listen to records, do that. I'm dating myself, records. I don't think I miss records anymore. Whatever they were.
And I'm nodding. That's so funny.
Yeah, records. So even mom didn't still have records. We had whatever. And so Nessa's advice was great. But my mother also had been very interested in palliative care years before she got her diagnosis.
How did that come about? How did she get interested in palliative care? Do you know?
There was a lecture I'm going to lose the name. It'll come back to me. But someone who's given the Sandra Goldberg lecture, who was lecturing in New York, Diane Meyer. And friends of mom said, let's go. This is an interesting topic. This is something we should engage in. I also think because my mother had spent, by that time, so much time in refugee camps, talking to people in all different stages of life and of crisis, that she was very open to this conversation.
Mm-hmm. How important was it for her that the palliative care was available?
It was hugely important, and it was important to the whole family. This is such a small example, but it was such an important example. I think it was partially mom's makeup and partially her generation that she didn't ask many questions of doctors. And she had a wonderful doctor who we adored, who was fabulous, who was open to any question my mother might ask. And she'd turn to my mother and say, do you have any questions? And my mother would say, yes, where are you going on vacation this year? We'd all say, mom, you know, I think. Maybe about your treatment, prognosis, anything. So, but she didn't feel, I think that had something to do also with the doctor and it being a doctor. The fact that people who worked in palliative care were available to all of us, we were all able to ask them questions that were very important questions. You know, some medical, I'm having pain at the bottom of my feet, she might say, is this something I should call Dr. O'Reilly about? Or is it okay to take this with that? Or whatever it was. And it kind of an ombudsman was very important because otherwise I think she just would have felt she was bothering somebody. It was very much her.
Well, that was something that came out, too. Because of who she was, and she was so used to giving and putting the focus and the spotlight on her causes and on other people, that she felt kind of embarrassed, you were saying, about having attention put on her.
Yes. Embarrassed, and she would come up with these things. She had to justify things. So when she got blood transfusion, for example, she'd say, well, I've given blood every year in blood drives since I was 21, so I guess I'm entitled to take a little of it back.
You also talk about trying to decode her, that when she said to your sister, for instance, who was thinking, should she move to Geneva, and your mother said, yes, go, did she really mean go? Or did she mean, no, I really want you to? No. I want to say go, but I want you to volunteer to stay.
That was a lot of the question, and that's what I meant a lot about that phrase, live your dying, is it was very important to my mother that in whatever time she had left, whether it was 3 months or 5 years, that she not spend all her time dying. And if everybody canceled everything they were doing and made big changes in their lives and hovered around her, that in some ways would have taken away her hope and taken away her life because she had a busy, active life. She had friends. She had activities. I remember at one point, and I mentioned this in the book, she said about a wonderful young friend of hers who we all loved, who's a very sweet person, but mom said, you have to call her and tell her that if she's going to cry all the time, she can't come over anymore. She said, I may be dying, but I'm not dead yet.
She knows her Monty Python.
Yes, exactly.
How did the book club come about?
Well, the book club started very naturally because all my life I've talked with mom about books. And it was very customary for one of us to say, what are you reading? And we love books, and we share books and trade books. Part of having a diagnosis like stage 4 pancreatic cancer is there are a lot of appointments. There's chemo, there's tests, there's doctor's appointments. And we all took turns, my father, my brother, my sister and I, friends. But I very often went with her to chemo. And we'd have anywhere from 1 to 7 hours sitting like this. And we started, as we always had, talking about books, but it was really from the very first time that I went with her to chemo that I realized the power of this, even if I didn't quite realize yet we were in a book club. And we were talking about a wonderful book called Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner. Has anyone read? Amazing, right? And I talked about this on the radio today. As the book starts, and don't worry, I'm not spoiling the plot, there's a woman and she's dying of cancer. And I was able to say to my mother, do you think her husband is going to be okay after that character dies? And my mother was able to say to me, he's going to be very sad, but I think he's going to be okay. And we weren't, of course, talking about the character or her husband. We were talking about my dad. And I realized very quickly that the books would give us that opportunity to talk about really difficult things, that they would also give us the opportunity to not talk about difficult things if we didn't want to. And I have to say, that very first time, I did say to Mom, you know, if we keep meeting like this and talking about books, it's kind of like a book club. To which she said, oh, don't be silly, it can't be a book club. And I said, really, why? And she said, there's no food. So I was going to say, it will be a foodless book club.
How did you choose which books?
The way we chose books, and it's very much in keeping with the theme, and one of the most important things I want to get across with this book, is we chose books exactly the same way we always had. If Mom read a great review of a book in the paper, we would read that. So we wound up reading a highly experimental novel by a wonderful African-American writer named Victor Laval 2 months before she died. It's called Big Machine. It's not a book that one would sort of naturally gravitate to if one had chosen, say, great classics, but it was a brilliant masterpiece of contemporary fiction, and Mom read about it in the Wall Street Journal, so we read that. We read those books you had on your bedside you'd always intended to read but hadn't.
Or pretended to have read.
Or pretended, I do talk about that. We read P.G. Woodhouse, who we loved. Mom read wanted to read a lot of Thomas Mann. She wanted to read some things she'd read and loved and reread them, so things like Murder in the Cathedral. Mm. Mom particularly loved contemporary writing by women writers, and we read People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. We read Patricia Highsmith. And I should add, too, that Mom was incredibly thrifty. So if you gave her a book, she would read it. So we read any book anyone gave us.
In fact, actually, I wonder if I could get you to read another short section, because you're talking about the women writers, and one of the ones that was chosen, I can't remember who chose it, you or your mother, Gilead.
Mom chose it.
And there's a Marilyn Robinson, she won the Pulitzer Prize for it. And I wonder if you could read just a little section from that section in your book.
Absolutely. Let me just find
it. It's on 96.
Oh, thank 96. You. I lost it briefly.
I have your book memorized.
Thank you. One of Mom's favorite passages from Gilead was, "This is an important thing, which I've told many people and which my father told me and which his father told him. When you encounter another person, when you have dealings with anyone at all, it is as if a question is being put to you. So you must think, what is the Lord asking of me in this moment, in this situation?" Mom thought about this question, she said, as much as she could, whenever she met refugees, bus drivers, or new colleagues. She thought about it now when she went for chemo and met the nurses, her doctor, the woman who scheduled appointments, other people with cancer and their families. The answer was different for every person and every situation. But the question from Gilead, Mom said, was always the same thing you needed to ask yourself. What is the Lord asking of me in this moment, in this situation? It helped you remember that people aren't here for you. Everyone is here for one another.
So beautiful.
I should add, in the book selection, there were certain books that were inserted into the reading, and I was too thick to realize why. And the reason was they were books that reflected my mother's Christian faith.
Well, in fact, that was something, because I think she was always sort of hoping that you would see the light.
She was.
One day.
She was. And she did say, and when we would discuss this, that it wasn't because she wanted to convert me in any kind of holy roller sense. It was because religion had been such an enormous comfort for her that she wanted the same for me.
And was clearly a comfort as she neared the end.
Huge comfort, yeah.
Did this process have, if not a religious and a spiritual impact on you? The correct answer is yes.
The answer is yes. It did. And I feel like, one of the wonderful things about books is they're there for you when you need them. Mm-hmm. And they can have this extraordinary way of putting themselves in front of you, a certain passage, a certain line. At one point, I was having a very dark night. I was blaming myself for a lot of things. I was upset, and I have terrible insomnia, which I chronicle at ridiculous lengths. And I came across a passage in, of all things, The Hobbit, which was a book that I had loved as a child, and still love, about our hobbit hero lost in the dark woods, crying out and unable to find his companions and realizing he would just have to wait for morning. And I feel that is a spiritual passage for me. That it may not belong to any particular religion, but it's the kind of spiritual passage that I find in lots of different books.
So beautiful. To just, and that is, there's a power in that, isn't there? Just wait till morning.
Wait till morning.
Morning will come.
Light will come.
Yes.
Morning, light.
In fact, through this process, you ended up quitting your job as a kind of a new dawn.
A new dawn. I had been intending to do that anyways.
Did your mother going through this, was that a kind of a little bit of a kick in the you-know-what?
It was a little bit of a kick in the you-know-what. And my mother felt too, and I had worked in corporate America for 21 years, and I had saved my pennies very carefully, so it wasn't that I was sort of quitting to retire, but I had a dream of something I wanted to do. I wanted to be involved in the internet era and found this cooking website. And there was a sort of tempus fugit message. And Mom felt very strongly that very few people are lucky enough to be able to quit their job and follow a dream. And she didn't feel it was good advice for everyone. Mm-hmm. She felt that so many people have debts and responsibilities and haven't been lucky to have the kind of job I had or to have been able to save the way I had. But if you were that lucky, you had a responsibility to do it.
If I can get back to the books for a second, because I was fascinated by the selection and I'm trying to put myself in that position. If I was with someone I loved and we were the End of Your Life book club, I think I would tend to sort of try to steer them toward books that I felt they should probably would be good for them at the end, you know, because I know I am all-knowing and all-seeing, benevolent. Did you feel that at all? Did you feel a response when it came your turn to choose a book? But well, I'm thinking this may be the last one she read, you know, you got to get it right, or did you just put it out there?
No, I felt it, and sometimes I felt I really got it wrong.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about that.
And there was once when I'd always heard that Continental Drift by Russell Banks was an amazing book. Has anyone read Continental Drift by Russell Banks?
Yeah, okay. So there's someone.
Good. Amazing book. But I'd heard that it was savagely depressing. I wasn't sure, and I had a conversation with Mom, a very important conversation about did she want to read depressing books, and we both loved depressing books, and we were good with that. And I gave it to her to read, and it was at her birthday. We were having a barbecue meal, and in the middle of the birthday, I said, so, you know, let's talk about the Russell. I couldn't wait to talk about it. And she said, that was the most depressing book I've ever read. And I thought, what have I done? I mean, I've given my mother the most depressing book she's ever read. And then the next morning when we talked, she said, I've been thinking all day about who I have to give that book to. I think it's absolutely wonderful and everyone should read it. And she loved the book. But yes, I thought maybe I had made a big boo-boo there.
There's also a wonderful moment when she starts to choose herself longer books.
Yes, I really felt that was a huge act of faith. We're reading The Coldest Winter by David Halberstam, or Joseph and His Brothers, 1,500 pages by Thomas Mann, or Roberto Bolaño, great writer. And the story with the only book actually that was part of the club that I didn't read was Joseph and His Brothers by Thomas Mann. And Mom started reading it at a point when her energy was really flagging, so the doctor had given her a prescription for Ritalin. Mm. So she actually read Joseph and His Brothers completely wired on Ritalin. And then she gave me the book, and I said, Mom, if you're not going to give me the Ritalin, I'm not going to read Joseph and His Brothers.
Did your mother talk about her dying?
She talked about it in very practical terms with me. She would every now and then come out with strange things, strange to me, like when people write you condolence notes, make sure you answer in blue ink, not black, because it's kind of depressing if it's black ink. So. And very matter of fact about that. But that's one of the great roles that the books played for us, because we were able to talk about very big issues of courage, faith, and death mm-hmm. without talking about them directly. In some ways, I wish I had talked more with her directly about it, but I kept getting the signal from her that she was too busy living. Yeah. And if she wanted to talk about a ballet she'd seen or Rachel Maddow on television or her grandchildren, which could be easily a 24/7 conversation with my mother because she was, her favorite thing in the world was being a grandmother. That's what she wanted to talk about. So the books really did allow us to talk about these things without talking about them head on. We did occasionally, but usually she wanted to talk about everything else.
I think that's one of the things that I learned when I was volunteering at palliative care is the person who is going through it will give you the signals, and you need to follow their agenda, not your own.
I came up with a metaphor at the time and when I was writing it, which is, for me, it was like being in a car with a driver who changes lanes without signaling. And so you have to be very attuned to the lane changes. That it's really up to you, and that it wasn't today I want to talk about death and tomorrow I want to talk about the grandchildren. It could change in a second. It could, 1 second you're talking about death, and then all of a sudden you're off to one of the grandkids' birthday parties. And I felt it was up to, as you say, exactly, it was up to me to try to follow. One thing that was hugely helpful, and I talk about it very early in the book, is one of her doctors gave us all a book to read. The whole family gave it to Mom to give us. It's called The Etiquette of Illness. And The Etiquette of Illness has great practical advice, and the best piece of advice was to say to my mother, not, how are you feeling, which even from a son who loves her is a kind of intrusive question, but do you want to talk about how you're feeling? And some days she'd say, yes, I do. And some days she'd say, no, I really don't.
I made many notes as I was reading, and I love this book on so many levels. As someone who loves reading, I loved hearing about it. But that was one thing I noted, and I have used since it. And it's wonderful advice whether someone is going through dying or going through any issue in their life, is instead of forcing them to talk about it, say, would you like to?
Yeah.
Which lets them know that you're aware, you're available, but you're not going to impose.
And it is true, any sort of life event. I mean, if there's an anxious bride and groom who you can say, do you want to talk about your wedding or not? And someone's like, no, you know, we don't. We're done with that topic for the moment.
Tell us about the end of her life.
The end of Mom's life was a very... sounds almost trite to say it, but moving and powerful experience for all of us. Mom died in mid-September of 2009. She sort of officially went on home hospice in June 2009. So we had wonderful access to all of the palliative care. We had the palliative care access, but also a hospice team as well. And there was a kind of peace which settled when Mom decided, based on the information she was given, that it didn't make sense to continue treatment. She'd been a year and 10 months on chemo without stop, and stopping chemo brought a kind of reprieve. And she decided she was going to have a wonderful last summer and do things she wanted to do quietly, and she had a remarkable time, really up until about a week before her death. And I was on a business trip fundraising for my website, and I was calling in every day as I did, and I called in, and Mom told me she'd stopped eating. So I canceled I knew what that meant. I got on a red eye, and I flew home, and I went right to the apartment. And when I walked in the apartment and saw her, and she was lying in bed, still, she was just happened to be lying in bed at that moment. She was still able to walk around the apartment. She was livid. She was furious with me. And she said, why did you cut your trip short? And I lied. I said, the meetings weren't any good, and I canceled them. I thought I might as well be here. And over the next couple of days, we had remarkable times. We all sat with her. We talked to her. I did say in the book, sometimes it was tedious. We would take turns, and there were hours when you couldn't believe how slowly that hour went. But we all got to have fun time with her, and she came to the dining table and ate with us Thursday night and Friday night. And then I think it was Saturday she was doing less well. Sunday she was really in and out and died that night. You couldn't make this up. The hospice nurse who spent the most time with us was named Gabriel. And he was wonderful, and we had people, and I just was deeply moved by these strangers, isn't the right word, taking such extraordinary care of my mother, being there in the room when we needed her to, keeping her comfortable, not being there when we needed time alone. I can count the book. We still had some extraordinary conversations, and I think my favorite to look back on was my brother was sitting with my mother, and he said to her, and this was very, very near the end, "Do you have any regrets?" And she said, "I always wanted a castle in Scotland." And I talked with my brother. I said, "Do you think that was the morphine?" And he said, "Nope, I think she always wanted a castle in Scotland."
Do you have any regrets?
I had a lot. I mean, and I talk in the book, too, how the sort of final book of our book club was I read a poem to her that I was supposed to read. The other thing I was going to do in California was I was going to be at my goddaughter's bat mitzvah, and I was going to read a Mary Oliver poem to him that my mother and I had picked out together. And when Mom was no longer conscious, I read this poem to her, and it's a gorgeous poem. When Mom died, I was racked with regrets. I should have said this. I shouldn't have said that. And they persisted for a while. And then one day, and I don't know how, I just let them all go, and they all went. And I had a kind of epiphany that it wasn't a particular speech I did or did not give in the last week. It was about our life. And I really didn't have regrets, and I felt so blessed for that, because I think that the people who I've talked to who had very difficult relations with a parent or with another loved one who died have a much more difficult time. Sometimes, maybe that's an untrue generalization, but I was able to look back, and I guess if I were to put in the category of regret, and I do feel regret is too strong a word for this, there wasn't anything I felt I should have said that I didn't say, but there were things I wished I'd asked.
Like what?
Just when her life, there were things about her life, her experience, her opinions, her views, that in the end of the day I realized that at least as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't about any speech that I neglected to give. It was the opportunity to get to know my mother more that was gone. And I've talked to a lot of people, and I've had a lot of people say the same thing to me, which is the movies always have these scenes where people deliver the big speech. And I didn't deliver the big speech, but I talk in the book about a moment where I thought I was going to, And then I decided not to. And then I was going to tell my mother I loved her. And then a different phrase popped into my head, and I said, I'm proud of you. And if there's one thing I'm particularly glad I did say, it's that. Because I think parents are forever telling their children that they're proud of them. Mm-hmm. But parents need to hear that we're proud of them, too.
How are you doing now? How have you been since your mother died?
I feel it's an ongoing... I feel the book and the opportunity to go to cities like this and meet people is my mother's final gift to me.
Yes.
I feel incredibly lucky.
Well, you've actually... Because we talked about this a little bit this afternoon. Obviously, your experience was very private and personal to you and your family, but because of this book, it's opened up this whole subculture you've jumped into and become kind of the banner waver for this, and you've met a whole lot of people who have shared the experience of palliative care, of being with someone who is dying. And has that changed your perception of it?
It's
not your personal experience, which of course is absolute, but
I mean, it's been a wonderful reaffirmation of humanity and all we have in common. And one of the great privileges of this has been, my mother accomplished a lot, but she wasn't a famous person. Her name was never in the New York Times. When she died, the New York Times, which is our hometown newspaper, didn't think her life was interesting enough for an obituary, so we placed a paid obituary like everybody else. And to me, she was both a very special person, my mother, but also representative in a way of a kind of ordinary hero of whom I've met thousands. People who are active in their communities, who volunteer at hospitals, who work in schools, who invite refugees into their home, who serve on palliative care councils, and who spend time with people who are dying in their families. And so I was a very optimistic person before. I've never been a cynic or a pessimist, but I'm way more now because I've been able to meet so many extraordinary people and hear so many stories. And one of the things the book made me realize is that there's a much bigger conversation that so many people want to have, but that our society shuts them down. And that often people are anxious about talking about death and dying, or they really want to talk about someone they loved who died. They really want to say, oh, you know, my best friend David, who I grew up with, who died, would have loved that movie, but it weirds other people out, so they don't. But it doesn't weird everybody out. There's so many people, and so I hope, in a way, I've learned that this kind of conversation can really be part of life.
Well, it's been so fascinating to watch the trajectory of your book, because your book, there we both know, you were a publisher, we both know astonishing books of great virtue and great virtuosity that disappear from sight without any success, and a whole lot of crap that, frankly, rises to the top sometimes. So it was so wonderful to see this book find such a readership and grow and grow and grow. And I wonder if you have a sense... Did you have any idea it would be as successful as it is?
I didn't. I didn't. I had no idea what it would do, how people would embrace it. We were talking about this before. The title, which is what I always wanted to call it and what I always thought it should be called, several friends of mine said, oh, are you making a big mistake? No one is going to buy a book called The End of Your Life Book Club. And
it doesn't even have a smiley face.
No smiley face. But there were things in the culture, books that I'd admired, How We Die by Dr. Sherwin Nuland, for example. So I just did that. It was a book I wanted to read, so I wrote it, and I hoped other people might want to read it too.
It's really a genius marriage of discussing little bite-sized reviews of books. So you get all of these, how many books are in there? I should have counted, but it's like half a dozen or so, or maybe more.
We significantly discussed over the course of this, but about 50-some-odd books. 150 are mentioned.
Really? That many?
We talked a lot about
slightly
books.
More than a dozen. I'm not very good at math, obviously. But you get bite-sized. So if you're interested, if you're a bibliophile, if you love reading, and I imagine most of you do, it's a great way to get a synthesis of not just what the book's about on the surface, but some of the deeper issues that you get at. But also it allowed you to talk about something that scares, as you said, most people. You get to map the end of your mother's life through talking about books.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I mentioned is my mother had the habit of she read the end of every book first.
Oh, right.
She never read a book without reading the end. And I mentioned that when you get a diagnosis of stage 4 pancreatic cancer, you know the end of that book. And it became a powerful metaphor, I think, for me, and in a way for Mom, too, of if you know the ending, in some ways you can enjoy the journey in a different way. And Mom would have felt very vindicated because there was a study this year that they did that showed that people who read the ends of books first enjoyed them more.
Oh, no.
Now I know. Uh-oh. Now I'm in trouble.
This man is clearly drunk.
So that said, I do not ascribe to this myself. And
have you ever done that?
No, I can't. I can't. And I spent the most magical time reading The Beautiful Mystery.
Oh,
I am crazy about this book. I was desperate to know what was going to happen. Mom would have skipped ahead, but but you know, and in all seriousness, and I'm not just saying this because you're sitting here, your prose is so beautiful, and the images are so gorgeous, that I sometimes read faster than I wanted to because I wanted to find out what was going to happen. And then it was like, oh my goodness, what a beautiful paragraph, what a thought. So the answer is you go back and reread it again. But there is something to, I think that's why Mom, she was able to savor the prose, the characterization.
Thank you. And that's also why I wanted you to read your sections from yours, because it really is. It's not just the power of the experience you and your mother are going through, but your ability to transmit it. And one of the many, many things I loved about it is that this is a very funny book, as you can imagine. It's, you don't expect it to be, but it's got huge amounts of humor. And
we had a lot of laughs. I mean, and I think anybody who's spent time in these kinds of situations knows that in that heightened sense of being, things can strike you as very, very funny, and things can turn in a heartbeat from something desperate to something that cracks you. But I didn't talk about this book in this particular book, because Mom and I didn't discuss it, but James Agee's book, I'm trying to remember what it's called, it's a wonderful book that was made into a play.
Sound familiar to anyone?
Anybody? Can anyone help me out?
Agee. We'll give you $100,000 if you want. He will give you.
A Death in the Family. That, yes. And the family, the father's dead, and it's everyone's devastated, and there will be no hope, no anything. They don't know how they're going to do it. And then something happens, and the next minute they're all laughing hysterically, and they can't stop laughing. And we had a lot of laughs.
That's life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Before we open it up for questions from the audience, I wonder if we could end this section with another reading, if you don't mind my imposing. It's page 128, please.
Thank you. And this is from a chapter called The Uncommon Reader. Mom and Dad had just returned from a trip to London, which was a place she'd lived as a young person and loved. And we had been reading Alan Bennett's wonderful book, The Uncommon Reader. I realized then that for all of us, part of the process of Mom's dying was mourning not just her death, but also the death of our dreams of things to come. You don't really lose the person who has been. You have all those memories. I would always have the summer in Godalming when I was 6 and learned to tie my shoe, and the year in England when Nina drank so much Ribena blackberry currant syrup that we dubbed her Nina Ribena. Nina was my sister. And the performance of Giselle in London I'd seen with Mom, my first ballet ever, when Baryshnikov and Gelsey Kirkland danced so brilliantly they got 17 standing ovations. And Mom and I stood side by side with tears rolling down our faces because it was so thrilling. I would even have the times that seemed awful then but looked hilarious now, when we arrived in Wales with no hotel reservation and it was impossible to get a room, and we'd driven for hours with me vomiting prodigiously all over my siblings in the back seat of the car. But we were all going to have to say goodbye to Mom taking her youngest grandchildren to a Broadway show, or to Harrods to marvel at the food hall and visit the pet store puppies. We were going to have to say goodbye to the little ones remembering their grandmother beyond a fleeting image or an imagined memory prompted by a photograph. We would need to say goodbye to Mom at their graduations and to her buying them clothes and to them bringing home boyfriends and girlfriends to meet her. We would also have to say goodbye to the joy of watching this next generation soak up the massive quantities of love their grandmother would have given them, and seeing them learn that there was someone in the world who loved them as much as their parents did, a grandmother who was delighted by all their quirks and who thought they were the most amazing creatures on earth. It was an idealized view of the future, but it was the one I carried in my head, and I don't think it was far off from the one my brother and sister and father and mother had. I was learning that when you're with someone who's dying, you may need to celebrate the past, live the present, and mourn the future all at the same time. Yet I had a thought then that made me smile. I would remember the books that Mom loved, and when the children were old enough, I could give these books to them and tell them that these were books their grandmother loved. The littlest ones would never see the British Isles through her eyes, but they could see it through the eyes of the writers she admired. They would soon be old enough to read The Railway Children by Edith Nesbit, and Swallows and Amazons by Arthur Ransom, and eventually Iris Murdoch and Alan Bennett. They could all be readers, and maybe even uncommon ones. Thank you.
It's been an extraordinary experience. This lecture is supposed to commemorate Sandra Goldberg, and boy, you've sure done a job. It's been wonderful. Bernard Lapointe is going to handle the questions. Bernard is a palliative care physician who's been in the field for many, many years, one of the groundbreaking people in this community. He's the Eric Flanders Professor of Palliative Care Medicine at McGill and the director of the Marjorie and Gerald Bronfman Palliative Care Unit at the Jewish General Hospital. And he's the face of Palliative Care McGill. So we're very pleased to have him.
So for those of you who want to ask questions, could you write them down? And people will come around. I'll start the ball. And I'm very happy with the excerpt you selected for at the end, because my question to you, and to you both, in fact, is that I'm always shocked by some deaths that end in silence. You know, the person goes, and there's a deep silence. And listening to you, reading the book, it's exactly the contrary. You know that death, the narrative, the story of your mother. And two questions. The first is, what did you discover of your mother that you really didn't know? And how is the book for your family? the legacy.
There wasn't any particular thing about my mother that I didn't know, but I feel like I got to know her much more fully. Actually, there is one thing, but I don't want to spoil it. It's in the book. There's a little surprise about her name, something I didn't know about her name, but I'm just going to make people read it to get that piece of information. So, for example, her sense of humor, I got to see more of it. I got to see it more fully. Part of it was, I think, a function of spending the time together as adults, that we're all so busy, and that we were a typically busy family, and her illness focused us. It gave us hours and hours together. So I think we all got to meet each other more fully. It forced us to take the time. And not just mom and me, but my brother and me, my brother and my sister and my father, because it was such an intense, typically intense experience. As far as the book, it's interesting. I was very careful at the start of it to say that if this is mostly about me and my mother, it's not because my brother and sister had any less powerful relation with her, or certainly my father. They were married 49 plus years. She died 2 months shy of their 50th. It's only because I feel that their stories are theirs to tell, if and when they choose, not mine. So my siblings and my father are very proud of the book, and they love that I'm traveling around and meeting people, and they, Lord knows, bought hundreds of copies and given them to people. But if people try to talk to them about the contents of the book, they'll say, that's Will's book.
Thank you. After experience with your mother's end of life, tell us how your life and your living are different now. Give us a couple of examples.
So I've been thoughtful myself now about palliative care and end-of-life issues, and I may sound like it's a wonderful question, and this may be an overly practical answer to it, but I've been very careful to have all my paperwork in place and to make my wishes known to my life partner, David, and to other people in my family, and I've really enjoyed that. I actually was surprised at how much pleasure it gave me to be thoughtful about that. I still don't read the ends of books first. But I'm also a little more careful about how I spend my time. And I'll look back on a week that's passed and try to identify things that I don't want to do again.
McGill hospitals are blessed to have outstanding volunteers as part of our palliative care L team, one of which was you. I remember, Louise, you were, and that struck me because you were doing interviews. You were doing the legacy project. Mm. She was not reading, it was not a book club, but it was literally her sitting and doing a life review. A life narrative. You were interviewing the person and giving this as a very precious gift to the family and to those who stayed. And so we are blessed. We have a lot of volunteers here in this room tonight. Did you or your mother have had volunteers on your team, on your health team, health care team, palliative care team? And upon reflection, what do you think their most helpful contribution could be or has been?
We had the benefit of a lot of volunteers on the team. And Mom had a long history of volunteering herself, starting as a candy striper when she was a young girl during World War II. And I think that reaction that I had talking about Nessa Coyle, who was a professional herself, not a volunteer, there's a whole other level of that with regards to the volunteers, too. When talking to someone who has given this gift of themselves and chosen to be present for you, There's a wonderful sense that you're not bothering them when you ask for something or ask them to come sit with you or to do whatever it is, the wonderful things that, that they do and have been trained to do. There's a gift not just of what they're doing for you, but the gift of not having to feel guilty or preemptive about requesting it. And I think that's something huge. They're there for that reason.
Yes, very much so. Another question. You mentioned in your book that it was your sister Nina who brought in the palliative care team of Dr. Kathleen Foley and Nessa Coyle. Was there not offered to you by the hospital? Could you have benefited from an earlier referral to the palliative care?
I think I was a little confusing in the book about that. Actually, the hospital introduced palliative care right away, and that also was, it was actually Dr. Foley who helped us find Mom's oncologist. So it was all of a piece right from the start. But we were incredibly lucky that Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is unusual for American hospitals, has a highly advanced sense of the place of palliative care in the process. I'm not saying that was a typical experience, unfortunately. I mean, there's lots of other hospitals that share that kind of highly advanced, but boy, are there a lot that don't.
And Dr. Foley is one of our great friend and mentor and was here on a couple of years ago for this lecture.
Yes, she and I talked about this. She sends her regards. She was amazing. She was so helpful to us.
A question from Peter. Were all the books fiction?
No, we read lots of nonfiction, ranging from Halberstam's The Coldest Winter, which is a huge book about the Korean War. We read popular philosophy, I would call it, like Wherever You Go, There You Are, by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Mom, we read a wonderful biography of one of the first women suffragettes. In England, a great parliamentarian. We read a great book by Sheila Weller called Girls Like Us about a biography of Carole King, Joni Mitchell, and Carly Simon. So we read, as I said, if you gave Mom a book, she would read it.
Was your mother able to read by herself near the end, or did you read to her?
The only time I read to her was in the last hours when I read the Mary Oliver poem. She died with a book by her side, this book called Daily Strength for Daily Need that she read from every day. As near as I can make out, I read about that was the last thing she read, and she read it to herself about 48 hours before she died. And there was a stack of books waiting for her to read them and for us to read them together.
Well, this is a tough one. It's not me who asked it, but do you fear your own death?
Do I fear my own death? I hope this doesn't sound ill-considered, but I don't. And there's a very particular reason that I don't, I think, for me, which is growing up as a young gay man in the early 80s, I spent 2 years of my life convinced that I must have AIDS long before there was an HIV test. So having spent 2 years thinking that I was going to die, I consider everything since then borrowed time.
I can understand that. Having the experience of your mother's death, what and how will you prepare or share with your children or the siblings' children when it is your time to go?
Okay. I want to go back. I want to jump back for 1 second because it's a very relevant answer. I genuinely don't fear my death. I do fear pain of any kind, including trips to the dentist. And I think one of the reasons I'm so interested in palliative care and its fullness, both as the spiritual environment it provides for family and friends and in congregations, is I'm really not keen to be in pain at any point in my life, especially the end. So hence a part of my interest in palliative care. As far as the sort of the legacy for the next generation, I have wonderful godchildren, and I have nieces and nephews. I did write the book partly for that purpose. I want to pass on the lessons of my mother's life and who she was. I love the idea of the legacy project. I think it's a need that I've felt so keenly talking to people is that losing somebody is obviously a devastating and catastrophic loss. But it seems to me losing the memory of them is to lose them all over again. And people have said to me, does it make you sad to travel around and talk about your mother? And the only times I really get sad are when I realize a couple days have gone by and I haven't thought about her. And to me, that's to lose her again. And as I said, I like talking about people who are no longer here. To me, that keeps them present. And I'm looking forward, whether they want to hear it or not, to telling my niece and nephews and godchildren who this person was and what I've taken from her life. And also the book she read. That I was so pleased you asked me to read that passage, because I love the idea of saying, here's Murder in Cathedral by T.S. Eliot. Your grandmother loved this book. And to me, that book helped make her who she was. Her moral sense was formed by that. And if I give them that book to read and they read it, they'll have a little bit of her too.
You know, I'm going through this right now, that these days, these months with my mom. And what strikes me is that I have an idea or an image of my mom. Okay, this is a personage, you know, she's like. And sometimes I'm flabbergasted by the conversations and what I hear. Sometimes it's like my ear, like, this thing. Is this the same woman? Where's the fit? Did you have that experience, like, per moment where, the person in front of you is not fitting with the person you have in your heart or in your mind?
Yes. It's remarkable. And I think why it's so profound is it almost calls into question everything you know about everything. If you can be that wrong about someone who you've known all your life, what is it you don't know? And yet how that's so exciting, that with each person in our life, I think, no matter how well we think we know them, there's so much more to know.
Did your mother know you were writing the book?
So about 2 months before she died, so when she was officially on home hospice, but still going around, going to her office, raising money for the Afghan library, seeing friends, doing her full range of stuff, I went over to see her. And I wound up saying to her, I want to write something about the book club, about the conversations we've had, about your life. It was very inchoate. I didn't really know what it was. I said, I really want to write something about the books, you, these conversations, what I've learned from you, what we learned from the books. And her immediate reaction was, oh, sweetie, why would you want to do that? You must have something else to write about. But the next day, I got an email from her, and it was a list of all the books we'd read in chronological order.
Familiar.
And then, very typical of my mother, a couple days later, there came an email, and it said, don't forget to talk about the need for health care reform.
Another question. You refer many times in the book to moments when you wanted to speak frankly with your mother about her dying. On several of these occasions, you felt you couldn't breach the subject. Occasionally, you felt you could. Could you speak a bit about navigating those moments with your mother?
About navigating those moments?
Yeah, those moments where you can't breach the subject, and sometimes you feel you cannot.
Yeah. It was a matter of trying to pick up on those signals. And she would say something that would make me think she really wanted to go there in the conversation. And I would start to go there, and then she would do or say something, change the subject, and I wasn't sure. And one of the hardest things, I think, was I wanted to be there for her to talk about it if she wanted to talk about it. but I didn't want her to talk about it if she didn't want to talk about it because she thought I wanted to talk about it. And when I, you know, the question about regret afterwards, the thing I had to let go of was re-examining those moments and second-guessing myself. And I did have regret, and then I let it go.
Did your mom die at home?
She died at home.
She died at home, yes. So one question is, after the book, you speak about her and so on. Do you visit her at the cemetery or the tomb at the cemetery? Does it help you?
So she's in, and she was very excited to bring us over to see where she'd be. She's in a columbarium in the church she went to, Madison Avenue Presbyterian. She got a really good spot because the beloved minister there, David Reed, who died a couple years before her, he's like here and she's like there, so it's good. And we had a ceremony when her ashes were put in the columbarium, but I don't. I visit her in the books. That's how I visit her, in poems, in passages, in books that we read and loved. That's what's meaning for me. Other members of my family go to the columbarium.
Question is, did you realize all of these things that you write about and in the book as you were living through them or only afterwards? How much of this is reflection and mindfulness of what has happened?
So part of it, I'm a real note scribbler. I don't know if you are. Do you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The notebook.
Notebook. I have many notebooks. I don't, unfortunately, write. I write whatever page is available, no matter where it is in the notebook.
Yeah.
So I'm not always sure what order things happen in. But it was important to me, part of my way of processing things is to make notes and to write and put thoughts. So throughout the whole course of this, I had observation, notes, thoughts. And I tried to be quite precise in the book about what I realized at the time and what I realized later. And there are very many points in the book where I'll say, I would realize later, or now when I'm writing this, I realize. But unless I said that, it was something I thought at the time.
Excellence in palliative care should include bereavement follow-up. Are you able to comment on what bereavement follow-up was given to your family and how it was helpful, if any?
They did offer us a sort of full menu of bereavement follow-up. We all actually had our own paths and sources, and so each one of us went in sort of different directions. And did not, as far as I know, take advantage of what was offered. But they were very good about explaining some of the options that were available.
Do you have profound insatisfaction with the healthcare system? Is it that rosy in New York? It sure is not in Montreal. I'm just reading a long question here, which is more a comment on the inadequacy of our system per moment and failure of professionals to either be attentive, present, or to communicate well. What was your experience?
We had... my experience is profound dissatisfaction with the U.S. healthcare system. Profound. We were lucky in some enormous respects. And the first respect we were lucky in is so unfair, which is that my mother was older than 65. So she had the full services of Medicare, which, whatever you say, but actually is quite... offers quite comprehensive things, including, in this case, full coverage of our palliative care and home hospice. If my mother had been 64 when she was nearing the end of her life, the story of this book might have been a horror story, really. My mother had also been a teacher, so she had TIA-CREF is what teachers, it's quite a good, and so, you know, the fact that the accident of how old you are and what you did for a living determine what kind of a book, what kind of an end to your life. Horribly unfair. And my mother thought it was, that was my mother's, you have to get the need for healthcare reform, because my mother thought it was terribly unfair that people, for no reason, got so much worse care than she got. We also, thanks largely to my sister who works in healthcare, she's, we're relatively demanding customers of healthcare. And the first doctor, oncologist my mother went to, he said to her, "Do you work outside the home?" And she turned to my sister and said, "He would never ask a man that question." And my sister said, "We're out of here." And she knew that wasn't the right, maybe he's a great oncologist, who knows, but that wasn't the right care for her.
The last question to Louise. Louise, when you write, you have such a depth of understanding of your personage, and you know, and you're responsible for many sleepless nights. I don't. Your experience in palliative care and that experience, like the legacy project and that you were doing, how is it integrated in your writing and your?
I think it had a life-changing. It was a life-changing experience for me. I didn't think when I volunteered for palliative care, I had no idea whether I would run screaming from the first room I went into. And there were very scary, as you know. I mean, not everybody just sort of drifts away nicely. You know, there's, some of it is pretty messy and pretty intimidating and very scary. And to realize that I could do it, that I could sit there and hold someone's hand and not make it about me, was very important. And I think having that, I mean, you talked about the privilege of being with someone at the end of their lives. You know, I think that informs all my books. It's important for me when I write about the dead that it not be trivialized, that they be fully realized as human beings. So I'm immeasurably grateful to my time in palliative care and my training as a volunteer to listen, to be there quietly, and what it taught me about living, what it taught me about dying, and it serves as a great role model for me.
Thank you. Thank you to all of you. Before we leave one another, I just want to mention that right after, when we're finished here, there's book signing by both authors in the room up there, and there's a small reception, so please stick around and share your reactions together. Across Canada, since Sunday, from coast to coast to coast, we're celebrating palliative care. And this is Palliative Care Week. And you've certainly heard that people were walking with their dogs in Prince Edward Island, walking in the snow still in Alberta, and people and the caregivers of a wonderful team of Palliative Care McGill, which are in our hospitals, the MUC, the Jewish General, St. Mary's, and Mount Sinai, and the children. We're playing bowling Thursday, just to show you that, like, palliative care is as well a celebration of life. So if you read about palliative care, share the article. If you are happy about the announcement of $15 million recurrent announced this week by the Premier of Quebec, write. If you're not happy about the way it will be spent, write as well. And I thank you again for being here and celebrating palliative care with us. Thank you, and thank you to both our audience.